Talking about the program we had coming up called Star Cars last week, there is, of course, always the opportunity to observe the sky at your convenience throughout the entire year. We have our observatory open every Saturday night, whether it's clear or cloudy. Now, unfortunately, we can't control the weather, to be honest, we could. This summer goes down in history as one of the most miserable summers we've probably had. Trying to get the observatory open, we bought a spectroscope, or the telescope, which allows us to do a little bit more than we did before. If it's clear, we're able to let you look at a star through the telescope, and then have a look at the same star through the spectroscope. You get a spectrum, and looking at the spectrum of the star tells us a whole lot about it. Of course, there are other objects up right now, like the Ring Nebula, and other Andromeda galaxy globular clusters, and if it is clear, we will have a look at those as well. If it's cloudy, however, we cheat. We have our own artificial light sources. We use diffraction gratings, which also produce a spectrum, and we can discuss what the light tells us while looking at the artificial sources. So hopefully you'll be able to come out any Saturday night throughout the entire year between 8:30 and 10:30. And of course, at different times of the year, different objects are up to look at. And now, for a man whose knowledge encompasses quite a bit of the spectrum, Jim Lovell.
Two lectures about Venus to bring you up to date, remind you where we are. I talked to you last time about the Pioneer Venus missions, which arrived at Venus last December. Six spacecraft sent by the United States, Orbiter Pioneer Venus 1, and the Multi-Probe Pioneer Venus 2, which before it got to the planet, broke into five pieces, separated, I should say, into five pieces, broke down, so it wasn't intended. The bus, which burned up the upper atmosphere after coming back from data about critical regions in any other atmosphere, and then the four probes which were designed to reach the surface and send back atmospheric data as they went down. The large probe or Sounder probe, which enters on the day side on the equator, and the day probe and night probe, which were two of the three small probes, which landed at 30 degrees south, respectively the day and night side, and finally the north probe, which landed in the polar ring at 70 degrees north, also on the night side. Those spacecraft sent back data, and as they descended through the atmosphere of Venus, and that lasted about an hour and a half total. These probes took about an hour and 15 minutes, and there was a little bit of spread in the time they went in, which means the deep space network has a problem for the first time in history of tracking and getting separate data from five different spacecraft, all of them in the same direction out there at Venus. And they were able to pull that off. And it's particularly remarkable when you consider my favorite statistic about Pioneer Venus, which is that the probes were designed to that they spin as they go down to the atmosphere. Pioneer is a spin-stabilized spacecraft, which means that they keep their orientation correct in the gyroscopic effect when they spin. The bus spins and the probe spin after they're released as a result. And what that means is that you cannot have an antenna that is aimed precisely at the Earth with a highly focused beam. You can pull that straight off on the larger spacecraft, the orbiter and the bus, by having a deep-funded antenna. The antenna sits up here in place of the Earth, the rest of the spacecraft spins around underneath it, and there is an actual motor which drives the antenna around and counteracts the spacecraft. Probes just weren't big enough for that. So the probes had to radiate energy essentially into an entire hemisphere in the general direction of the Earth, and the Earth has got a tiny fraction of that energy. The result being that the signals from each of the probes, as they descend through the atmosphere of Venus, and in the case of the day probe, as it's been transmitted for 67 minutes on the surface, the strength of that signal as received on Earth was 1/100 of 1 billionth of a watt. Which means that if one of the probes had sat there on Venus for the entire 4.5 billion year history of the solar system and transmitted data to Earth at that energy, that received level of energy, and you had saved up all the energy received on the Earth, you would now have enough electricity to light a 7.5 watt Christmas tree bulb for 1/5,000th of a second. That is 4.5 billion years worth. That is the strength of the signal on which the Pioneer Venus probe data, which I'm telling you about in these two lectures, were obtained.
If you cool the 50 helium to 450 degrees below zero Fahrenheit, so as to minimize the amount of noise the receiver itself sends in the signal, and the Chilean army closed the entire Pan-American highway for 3 hours to keep out one motor with a detected ignition who had been cruising up and down the path to San Diego practice station in practice runs during the previous week.
and generally noise of his own. There are some strange benefits of having military dictatorship in the world, and this is pretty natural, but one of them. The whole story is quite a remarkable one. The Russians also sent four spacecraft to Venus. Again, each one, there were two separate launches. Venera, that's the Russian word for Venus, and I've often incorrectly mispronounced Venera in the past. I apologize to you, whatever Russian pronounced it is Venera. Venera 11 and Venera 12, but one of them, the one that was launched second, which was Venera 12, was faster than the first one, and so they passed each other along the way, and it was Venera 12 that got there first. And that was on December 22nd of last year, and then on Christmas Day, which of course in Russia doesn't mean anything, Venera 11 landed. The Russians made the opposite decision that the Americans did about having two spacecraft, of which one is launched first, but the other one arrives first. We had a situation with Voyager, and we decided to name the order the Lyra order, and so Voyager 2 was launched first, and Voyager 1 got to Jupiter first, and we'll get to Saturn first. Russians decided to name the launch order, so we had to solve the Venera 12 and 11 mission. These spacecraft, look at the first slide, you can see what they look like. And if you get everybody looked at them, they're very elaborate spacecraft. This is a picture of one of them. The Russians have not told us which, but it doesn't matter a whole lot because they're essentially identical. As it sat on the ground before the, well before the launch. Number 12 up there, the man gives you a scale. See, it's a 5-ton spacecraft. And it's split into two parts. The majority of it, well, the Russians have had two different series of Venus landers. As I mentioned last week, they have been landing on Venus. They've done it 6 times so far. They've been doing it ever since 1970. But their first series were relatively small spacecraft in which basically they were engineering test vehicles. They were trying to find out how to do this extremely difficult thing of landing on and surviving in that very, very hostile environment, even for a few minutes or for a few tens of minutes, or the record now is 2 hours and 10 minutes of Venera 12. They had to find out how to do that, and they had a lot of failures before they finally succeeded, but they kept at it, and they did succeed. Then, when they were pretty well confident they knew how to do it, they switched to this very, very much larger version, these 5-ton deals. And the spacecraft basically consists of a landing capsule, which would be spherical and would be up there where the man is standing, so obviously it's not shown in the picture. And then a bus spacecraft, which has a primary function of delivering the lander to the planet. The bus, in the case of the first ones of these very fancy, highly instrumented scientific versions, went to orbit around the planet. And it turned out that that wasn't a terribly useful thing to do. The data obtained from the orbiters on Venera 9 and 10 were of very low quality. The pictures in particular are absolutely lousy. We got a little bit of useful information, but not a whole lot. And the problem was that the landers turned out to have been built so well, you know, this 2.5-inch thick insulation they had and that sort of thing, that what caused them to stop transmitting their data from the surface was not the fact that they had been killed by the temperature or pressure, but the fact that the orbiter through which they were relaying their signals had set. Its orbit had taken it below the horizon, as seen from the landing site. The Russians did just the opposite of what we did on all four of these recent Venera landers, the heavy scientific ones. We landed on the base, on the side of the planet that was toward the Earth. We had to, because our probe communicated directly to the Earth. There was no relay. The Russians relayed, and in all four cases, they had landed on the side of Venus that faced away from the Earth at the time. So they had to relay through the bus. And so what the Russians decided to do this time was, apparently, in order to get longer transmission time, sacrifice the capability of going into orbit, not put the bus into orbit, let it simply fly past the planet, and that means that it had a less sharply curved path as it went around, and therefore stayed above the lander's horizon longer, and was able to transmit data longer. It worked, but it didn't work all that well. Venera 12 did set the all-time record for transmission from the surface of Venus, but it was only 3 minutes longer than the previous record, and even when compared with Venera 9 and 10, the previous record was Venera 8, even compared with Venera 9 and 10, it just wasn't that much longer, and I suspect the Russians are going to go back to orbiters the next time around. Particularly since, I'm sorry to have to tell you this, but the entire lander mission was a total failure. And that is really shocking. It's the first time it's ever happened to the Russians on Venus. They had so much trouble with landing on Mars, they have now given up. They've passed the word that their planetary program for the foreseeable future is going to be exclusively Venus. Which is really strange, because Mars is a harder planet to land on. But for some reason, the Russians are able to land on Venus, and they've never been able to land on Mars, and they've had a whole series of attempts which failed and kept doing things like the lander would fail a few seconds before or a few seconds after the landing.
And possibly that's because they did not do what we did on Viking and choose their landing site very carefully. They're hardwired, they have to land at a particular place no matter what. And if you land at random on Mars, our data imply, the chances are you come down a rock. And apparently the Russians are just not very good at coming down on rocks. We're better at it. Our design is better at it than they were, than theirs is, and also we have the capability of landing in a place where at least the rocks are minimized. Question down here or an answer?
No, you just said it's okay. Hard to land on Mars.
Right. I said it's hard to land on Mars. I'm sorry. It's easier to land on Mars, and you'd think, and also you think the Russians would have especially good luck with it because it is, after all, the red planet. But the fact is they have not. Thank you. If you have questions, by the way, don't try to raise your hand, but don't try to save them to the end either. You know, get it out while you're still confused, rather than being confused with the whole lecture. If you have a question, just yell question, or Jim, or yell funny looking, or, you know, anything that will get my attention short of throwing tomatoes, and I'll be happy to answer it. So, in any case, let's show you, number 10 there is the antenna which transmitted the data from the orbiter to, from the bus rather, from the flyby this time, to the Earth, and it is highly focused and has a directional beam. The design that they use here is not spin stabilized, and so you don't have that particular problem. Here is what the lander looks like. It would be inside a big spherical shell, which is 9 feet in diameter, at the time that it is released from the orbiter. And that spherical shell serves as a heat shield so that the heat, not the temperature down the surface yet, but the heat of air friction of entry into the atmosphere is taken up by that shell. And then at a certain height, the shell is jettisoned, the parachutes begin coming out. They use a series of 6 parachutes, one after another. And, well, the last 3 are all together, and they're absolutely huge. But then, as the Russians learned the hard way sometime back, you got to cut your parachute loose somewhere up around the middle of the clouds, or else you will drift down so slowly because the air is getting so dense. Remember I told you last week, think of it as more like landing in water on the Earth than it's landing in the atmosphere of the surface of the Earth. The air becomes so dense that you simply die while you're still on the parachute. You're killed by the heat and pressure while you're still on the parachute. So they jettison the parachutes about 30 miles up, and they begin to fall faster and faster and faster, but then as the air gets denser, this thing, which is simply the back of the reflector, this is the antenna, number 2 is the antenna, that transmits the data from the lander to the flyby, and 3 is a reflector for that, but its back surface is used as a sort of poor man's parachute, which gives you enough air resistance that it slows you down, and you hit the surface of Venus at only about 15 miles an hour. The large probe, the small probes, the 3 of them on the Pioneer Venus Moni probe, did even better than that. They had no parachutes whatever, and they hit the surface at only 25 miles an hour. That is a really dense atmosphere by the time you get down there to the bottom. This spacecraft is designed to survive the landing, of course, unlike the Pioneer Venus probe, and so there is a shock absorber, this ring-shaped device down there, and you can see the laser shock absorbers in them, which take up the shock of the landing, so you'll be happy to know there is a bumper somewhere in the universe that can withstand a 15-mile-an-hour crash with no damage. Number 6 is a place where whoever took the photograph has removed covers for you so that you can see the scientific instrumentation inside. You can see there are various arms down here that are designed to deploy various instrumentation on the surface. And you can also see the camera, number 1. We know from the Mirror 9 and 10, so is the camera. I think I've explained everything except number 4. Those are cords which intercommunicate between the bus and the lander while the lander goes at your bus. Number 1, though, is the camera. Now, this is very interesting, because after they got down, of course, the first question everybody asked is, well, hey, how'd the pictures turn out? Huh, show us the pictures. There weren't any pictures. Cameras didn't work. And so after the fact, the Russians tried to make us believe, well, we never told you we were going to send cameras, but unfortunately, they already released these pictures, and the cameras very prominently shown there in the front, and, you know, we asked what the Russians were, you know, we asked the Russians, well, what are those things in the pictures? Well, I guess those were warts, I don't know. what happened was they did get some very useful data on the way down. Ironically, their lander mission sent back good atmospheric data, which was supposed to be what our Pioneer Venus was about, and some of the data were able to confirm our observations. They had, as I mentioned last week, the same discrepancy between the gas chromatograph and the neutral mass spectrometer as we did, those being the 2 instruments to measure what the air is made of, and those discrepancies seem to have been resolved now in favor of the gas chromatograph, which is sort of a shame because that's the one that gives you the lower values of, for example, amount of water vapor below the clouds. But still a good deal more than we expected. The Russians had one instrument that we did not have, and that was a device to try to detect radio signals of natural origin from Venus. And it was as a result of that, on the way down, on the nearest well, since I was the first one to land, that the Russians discovered that there is continuous, loud thunderstorm activity going on all the time over much of the surface of Venus. And that is very, very hard to understand, because the clouds are made, or at least a major constituent of them, is droplets of concentrated sulfuric acid, as I mentioned last week. Sulfuric acid is such a good conductor that they use it as the electrolyte in your car battery. And it's very hard to understand how the separation of charges, you know, plus charges migrating to one side of the cloud particle and minus charges migrating to the other side, the large separation of charges that is necessary before you can have a lightning discharge can occur on a cloud particle which is made of a very, very good conductor. The obvious possibility is that where the separation of charges occurs is in cloud particles which are made of something else other than sulfuric acid that is a better, that is not a good conductor, and that's, you know, the going arm waving hypothesis at the moment. We confirmed from orbit the Russian detection of ferrite, which is the technical term for those vats of radio static that you get from a thunderstorm. You know, you're trying to listen to your AM radio on a summer afternoon and it goes zap, zap, zap every time there's a lightning bolt. Well, those are referred to as ferrite, S-F-E-R-I-T-S. And we detected the ferrite even from orbit over the night side of Venus. So there is lightning on Venus, and that's a major discovery in that it shaked us up. It tells us that we did not understand lightning and the processes that caused it as well as we thought we did. But when they got down to the ground, the initial report was they were hearing constant lightning. They also had a microphone to try to pick up thunder. Apparently the Russians felt ahead of time that there was a reasonable chance there would be thunderstorms on Venus. Never occurred to us. You know, the fact that we were able to confirm it was just because we happened to have an instrument along that was sent for an entirely different purpose. But the Russians had a live microphone, which they landed on Venus in each of the two spacecraft, and this is the first time that a live microphone has ever been landed on another planet. And had there been anything useful from that microphone, I would have been able to get to the tape. I'm sorry to say that there wasn't. At first, what it looked like was, well, apparently what happened was, none of the data from any of the devices except that lightning package, the spherical detector plus the microphone, which sent back their data together, none of those data was sent back. Apparently because the sequencer, which was supposed to switch the transmission from sampling one instrument to sampling the next instrument to sampling the one after that, stuck on the lightning experiment. And this was a design defect, not an accidental failure, because it happened on both spacecraft. And so all that we got was data from the lightning package. And to make the whole thing totally useless, the lightning package on both spacecraft failed upon landing. And so all we have is useless data, noise. The first story was that they heard continuous thunder from the ground after landing. That was a TASS dispatch, TASS being a Soviet press agency. Apparently Soviet reporters are about as accurate in their accounts of spaceflight as ours are, because that was totally wrong, absolutely mistaken. The second story, which was from the first report that any Russian scientist gave out, which was published in January, and we got a copy of it before publication at Ames Research Center, was that they heard one very loud sound on Venera 12, 25 minutes after landing, and it was very loud, it was 85 decibels. And the latest story is, no, even that was just noise in the instrument. And so the whole lander portion of these missions established nothing except that it transmitted. It transmitted no data, but it did transmit for longer than anybody has ever succeeded before on the surface of Venus. Now, what impact this is going to have, this massive failure, the first one the Russians have ever had on Venus, since their first successful landing, what impact this is going to have on their lander program, we do not know. The reason that they never tell us ahead of time what they're going to do, excuse me, on their next Venus mission, is they don't know themselves until the last one has happened. They use a different design philosophy from the one that we use. Instead of having a separate spacecraft built from scratch for every mission, and that takes years and years and years of preparation, so you have to decide many, many years before you fly it what you're going to have, the Russians use the same basic design of spacecraft, accepting the inefficiency that necessarily entails, and simply plug in different instruments when they decided on the basis of the results from the previous mission what they would like to, what questions they would like to ask for the next one. And so every 2 years or so, there's a chance for the Russians to launch spacecraft to Venus, and they have not missed such a launch window for a very long time now. We will see whether they miss the next one, whether this massive failure has caused so much reverberation that within their program that they're going to have to skip a launch window before they can get their act together.
I can see people within their program arguing either way. You know, it was basically an engineering failure, so let's repair that sequencer and send the same package of instruments. Or I could picture people saying, well, look, you already tried that package of instruments once and it was a disaster, so, you know, let's do something completely different. We do know that there will be a joint Russian-French spacecraft sent to Venus in 1983, which will put a balloon into the atmosphere of Venus, high enough above the surface that it will not be exposed to the really severe temperature. And that balloon will float there for some long time. They haven't told us how long. They have not told us what instruments will be on the balloon, but it should be very interesting to see what that picks up. Almost certainly there will not be a camera on the balloon, because the air is so dense that simply the clear air, without even any cloud particles, scatters light so well that you cannot see the ground below about 4 miles up. So they might have a radar mapper, but they probably would not have a camera. If you went down to 4 miles up, you'd be down to a place where the temperature was already very, very high. Question?
Yeah, I'm not real sure, but I have this impression that sulfuric acid is a wonderful conductor in the water.
Non-conductor. Well, it's not totally without water. It's about 70 or 80%. So there is water in there, and it's good enough to be a conductor. You would not use acid that concentrated in a car battery, probably because it would be dangerous, actually. Probably because lesser concentrations are better conductors, but this is still a good enough conductor that what I said is relevant. Okay, here is the final picture of Venera 12 or 11. Again, you see humans down there for scale. This is where the aeroshell, that spherical capsule for the lander, would go. Number 8, these bed springs, are the antennas that pick up the transmission from the ground. And then around on the other side, I showed you that big dish antenna sends the data back to the Earth after amplification inside the flydock. And finally, number 9 is the solar cells, which generate power. Okay, that pretty well takes care of what the Russians did on Venus. I'm sorry to be able to report that in such a short time. All I can say is they are known for their persistence. They do not give up when they have failures, and we have a tendency to do that. And I'm sure that whether they miss the next launch window or not, they will be sending spacecraft to Venus. That lander had very sophisticated instrumentation, much more so than they'd ever used before, and it's a major tragedy that we lost the data. For example, it had a soil analysis instrument, which would have given data that would have been very useful in combination with our detailed data on the composition of the atmosphere, because we are quite sure that there are all kinds of chemical reactions between the soil and the atmosphere. And, you know, at that temperature, and an atmosphere charged with things like sulfuric acid, the sulfuric acid doesn't make it down to the surface. The sulfuric acid is so hot that the sulfuric acid molecules are broken into pieces 15 miles above the ground. But those pieces are reactive, and we could imagine all sorts of chemical reactions going on between the air and the surface, such as happen on no other planet. It'll be very, very interesting to find out what they're like, what produces weathering on the surface of Venus. We know that there is weathering. We've seen that in the only two pictures that have been sent back so far from the Venus surface, the Venera 9 and 10 pictures, which I showed in my last lecture series. Okay, let us get back to Pioneer Venus. Here is the first picture of Venus that was taken by Pioneer Venus 1, the orbiter. I'm sorry, this is the second picture. Everybody's heard of the first picture, so I thought I'd show you the second picture. The dots, of course, are not stars. They're dust on the picture. And I think your first impression of this picture is that it's staggeringly uninteresting, especially as compared to those very detailed ultraviolet views from Mariner 10 that I showed you last time around. Last week. This is an ultraviolet picture, too, for reasons that will be obvious from what I said last week. They didn't bother to even include a capability of imaging Venus in any wavelength other than ultraviolet on Pioneer Venus 1, because you simply don't see any detail, you don't see the contrast. But what you don't see in this picture is the contrast between the areas that are more reflective in the ultraviolet and the areas that are less reflective in the ultraviolet, that are darker in the ultraviolet, although equally reflective in the visible. And that fact that you do not see that turns out to be very important. Negative evidence is important in science also. Remember Sherlock Holmes, what did the dog? What was the strange thing the dog did in the night? The dog did nothing in the night, that was the strange thing, implying that the criminal was someone the dog is familiar with. Well, same sort of thing here. The fact that you don't see that ultraviolet absorption tells you right away that wherever the ultraviolet absorption is happening, it is not in the upper cloud layer. To jump ahead, I'll explain that moment. To jump ahead for a moment, Pioneer Venus Modipro found out that there are three major layers of clouds on Venus, the upper, middle, and lower layers, and then there are thin haze layers above the upper and below the lower cloud layer, and I will show you a detailed map of the structure of the clouds of Venus a little bit later on. And what's happening is the mysterious ultraviolet absorber, whatever it may be, is not in the top layer, it is in the middle layer. And that is proved by the fact that when you are looking at a more or less full Venus, as Mariner 10 was, in other words, when the sun is shining from more or less directly behind you and illuminating the atmosphere from right along your line of sight, then you see the contrast. But when you look at a crescent Venus, where the sunlight is coming in from an angle that is very, very different from the angle of your line of sight, you do not see the contrast. Why does that prove that it's on the in the middle cloud layer? Well, if we could have the lights up just enough so people can see me gesticulate, I think I can explain that. Sorry, I realize I'm taking your people by surprise there. I didn't know I was going to do this. Okay, if you imagine that I got to answer the question separately for two different parts of the picture. This part, this edge of the image is referred to as the terminator. That's the boundary between the day side and the night side, whether having sunrise or sunset. In this particular case, let's see, this planet rotates in the wrong direction, rotates in that direction, so this is the sunrise terminator. This, the geometric edge of the disk as seen from a particular position, is referred to as the limb. I've got to explain to you why both at the limb and the terminator of a crescent Venus, as opposed to a full Venus, where of course you have no terminator, there's a limb, or the terminator is a long limb, in a crescent Venus, you do not see the contrast if it is in a lower layer. The reason is that your line of sight, in both cases, for separate reasons, does not penetrate to that lower layer. When you are looking at a crescent, you are seeing only the uppermost cloud layer. In the case of the terminator, that is for a very simple reason. The sun is not shining on the middle cloud layer anymore. It's shining only on the upper cloud layer. The middle cloud layer has already, from the middle cloud layer, the sun is already set. In the same way, if you're flying over mountains, you can see how, or clouds above flat land, you can see how the high stuff is still illuminated by the sun just after sunset, even though the ground that is lower is darker. Or if you look through a telescope at the terminator on the moon, you can see the edges of craters, the raised ring walls of craters, as bright circles, even though the depressed interiors are dark. Okay? So it's exactly that physics. We're not seeing the middle layer there for the simple reason it's not being illuminated. At the terminator, what's happening is your line of sight is coming in parallel to the surface of Venus, not perpendicularly to the surface as it would be if you were looking at the middle of the image, as you were able to do on a full Venus image, which you can on a crescent Venus. Well, if this is the surface of Venus, and there's some atmospheric layer here, I think you can see if your line of sight is coming directly down, you're not looking for all that much atmosphere. Okay? If you're looking at the terminator, at the limb, rather, your line of sight is coming in at an angle, and you're looking through a long, long air path. That would be the case if the air were transparent. But this air is not transparent. It has material in it that prevents you from seeing below a certain depth, namely the clouds, which, remember, are thin and fuzzy. They are not, they don't have well-defined edges the way the clouds on Earth do. And so what happens is, you're able to see a certain distance into the clouds. In the case of looking straight down at the middle of a full Venus, you are able to see down to a certain depth in the atmosphere. In the case of looking straight in at the limb of a crescent Venus, you're able to see the same distance, but that doesn't get you very far down into the atmosphere towards the surface. You understand this? And so when you're looking at the limb, you are seeing only the upper layer. And the fact that you don't see that, that you don't see these features here, whereas you do see them in a full Venus, tells you that it is not at the top. Okay, lights down, please. Tells you that it is not at the top that the atmospheric absorption is occurring. And lo and behold, as Venus moves around the sun, and the orbiter staying in the same orbit, over it, saw more and more and more of the lighted portion of Venus every day, until it finally came onto a crescent Venus in full Venus rather in February. Lo and behold, the old familiar Mariner 10 absorption markings began to appear, and now in February we can see them just fine. Then Venus shrank to a crescent again, and we began to see things like this again, and so on and so forth. Yeah?
What was that irregularity at 11 o'clock on the
limb? Irregularity at 11 o'clock on the limb. Listen here. Defect in the picture transmission. It's not a mountain sticking up through the clouds. I guarantee it. Nor is it a higher local cloud. And the reason I can tell that is I can see something up here that you probably can't see from down there. It's perfectly rectangular and lined up with the scan line. Here's a picture with, you see a fatter crescent, and lo and behold, you're beginning to see those dark spiral cloud marks. See that? And you're beginning to see a hint of brightening down there, which would be the south polar ray. Here is a more nearly full Venus, and that could very easily be one of the Mariner 10 pictures. I picked this one because it is the one that of all the pioneer Venus orbiter pictures published to date looks the most like the Mariner 10 picture. You can see some differences, though. For one thing, polar wind is twice as bright now as it was in 1973, and we don't know why that is. For another thing, we have the wave features that appear over this part of the planet, and we didn't really see those very well, in my understanding. But the main thing we were in Pioneer Venus Orbiter is that despite the simplicity of its meteorology, Venus is a lady who can put on many faces, and she doesn't always look the way she does here or the way she did in Mariner 10. For example, before I illustrate that, before I think I go on to something else, this is part of the proof that, in fact, this is additional proof that, in fact, that ultraviolet absorber is in a lower cloud layer, so the middle of the three cloud layers, and that the places where we see this ultraviolet dark appearance are places where there is a thinning in the upper cloud layer, through which our line of sight is capable of penetrating the upper cloud layer and going further down, as opposed to the right region, which is a place where there is not such a thinning, and our line of sight is terminating the upper cloud layer. It gets hotter and hotter. This is the disk of the planet. This is the terminator of our cell. The North Pole is right about there. And so you're seeing some on the night side, you're seeing some on the day side. And this is produced by the infrared radiometer on the orbiter, which is a device that measures temperatures from a distance by looking at the infrared emission that is produced by any hot object. And it's been color-coded so that the higher the temperature, the brighter the color. And so this is cold over here, this is hot over here. And we're seeing here at a level, we're seeing down to a level within the upper part of the cloud layer. Well, what it turns out, it's not obvious in this picture, but it does turn out, that this picture looks the same as the visual pictures do. That is to say, looks the opposite. That is to say, the hottest places are where we see the dark markings on the ultraviolet picture. And so that shows that those hottest places, that those dark places are warmer, and therefore that we are seeing further down into the atmosphere, in other words, that they're whole. So you see we've got two independent lines of evidence. One, the fact that you see the dark markings only at a full Venus phase or close to it, and two, these infrared data, which conclusively show that, in fact, the dark areas are lower places that we're seeing through thinning in the upper cloud layer. Now, here's that map that I put on the view of the structure of the Venus clouds, and I realize this is a very complex diagram, but if you let me walk you through it, I think you'll see it's not as complex as it seems to be to start out. I'm sorry about the people in the back. I will do my best to give you verbal descriptions of this as much as I can. I realize you're not able to see everything. But basically what we've got here is data from two separate instruments on the large probe, and those are the nephelometer and the large probe cloud particle size spectrometer, or LCPS. Which I think you'll agree is easier to say than large probe cloud particle size spectrometer, especially after having heard Martini. This is water. There are a lot of instruments on these various spacecraft, and there is a code designation for each of them, which starts out either L for large probe, M for multiprobe if you have them in all the multiprobe, S for small probe, or O for orbiter, and there are 34 separate instruments, and you can go crazy trying to remember all of them in mind. But these are data from two of them. The nephelometer is basically a cloud radar, and it was carried on all four of the probes. It's a radar, except that instead of using radio signals to detect something that is out there, it uses infrared. No technology freaks, not from a laser, from a light-emitting diode, which in fact is equally remarkable in many ways. And what it does is to detect the cloud particles exactly the same way as you determine that you are driving through fog at night. That is, it sends out a beam of light, and if you are driving through fog, all of a sudden the beam of light becomes visible. And so it measures how much brightness is reflected back as it looks in the direction where the beam of light would be if it were in fact visible. The reason that it becomes visible is the cloud particle suddenly starts scattering light backward in the direction that it came from. Well, the nephelometers are so sensitive that they can detect cloud that is so thin that visibility within it is 4 miles, or cloud that is so thick that visibility within it is 4 inches. And I suddenly realized, having looked at this a little bit more closely, that the whole...
Here is the height above the Venus surface, and I've drawn in the original scale is in kilometers, but I've drawn in 20 miles, 25 miles, 30 miles, 35 miles, and 40 miles. And then we've got three different curves, of which I'm not going to bother with the middle one, something called extinction coefficient. A few of you would care about it already know what it means anyway, and for the rest of you, well, it's just a way of expressing how far you can see in the cloud, but it doesn't express it in a terribly useful way. And I already told you ways that are more meaningful, I think, to most people last time, namely that in most of this so-called cloud, it's really nothing but a thin smog, and you can see for several miles through it. In the densest region, which is the lower cloud region, which is only a mile in vertical height,
but is by far the greatest amount of material in the clouds. That is the only place where you would not be able to see further than about half a mile. And even there, visibility would be a great deal farther than it is inside an earth cloud as you fly through an airplane.
The blue curve tells you how many particles there are, how many cloud particles there are,
irrespective of their size. The size is measured in micrometers. A micrometer, which is what used to be called a micron, still is by a lot of scientists who haven't got the word yet, but since 1948, the word is supposed to be a micrometer. I'm always amused by scientists who criticize the public for not using the metric system. They are ferociously resistant to change in the metric system. And, you know, they're still using CGS units all over the place and so on. But that's another story.
The particles are given in micrometers, and a micrometer is 1/25,400th of an inch.
Okay, it's a millionth of a meter, which is to say it's a thousandth of a millimeter, which is to say it's 1/25,400th of an inch.
And the clouds in the upper cloud region here, we don't have data for this particular instrument from the haze layer that's up above it, but there is a very, very thin haze layer above it, and it's very much like the one that we're going to have down here, so you're not missing a whole lot. This is a diagram which shows the number of particles of different sizes. And this is number per cubic centimeter, the scale of 100, 200, 300, 400, 500 particles per cubic centimeter of size, 1 micrometer, 1.5 micrometers, 2, 2.5, 3, and if they're wearing it, they're 3.5, 4, 4.5, and so forth. Now, I think you can see that in the uppermost of the three cloud layers, the particles are exclusively very, very small, most of them 1 micrometer in size.
Those, presumably, are the sulfuric acid particles that we see from the Earth, because after all, the layer that we see from the Earth is the uppermost cloud layer.
Then you have a middle cloud layer, which extends from 35 miles, or the top of the upper cloud layer is up somewhere around 50, 55 miles.
I can't give you a definite figure for that, because it sort of peters out as you go up. It doesn't have a well-defined upper edge. And at some point you say, well, all right, we're out of what we'll call a cloud layer and into a very thin haze layer.
Somewhere around 50 miles up. Between 35 miles and about 33 miles, there is this middle cloud layer where all of a sudden you have a much more complex structure. You have lots, okay, now this is another of these histograms of the particles, but they change the scale on. There is 0 micrometers to 5 micrometers. On this scale, 0 to 5 is just from there to there. So this scale is very much compressed, and I wish they hadn't done that because it's very easy to get confused. But there is that peak. You have the 1 micrometer particle, but if you look at the number scale per cubic centimeter, you find there are many fewer of them. That goes from 0 to 60, and this is going from 0 to 500. So there are only about a tenth as many of the 1 micrometer particles. However, we have a new population of particles that average around 4 micrometers in size, and yet another population of particles that average 8 to 10 micrometers in size that go on out to 30 and even more. And since those particles, these are referred to as mode 1, mode 2, and mode 3, the significance of plotting this is that in a cloud that has had a chance for the particles to interact with one another at all, you cannot have separate population distributions like this if they're all made of the same substance in the same physical state. So if you're seeing three different populations of cloud particles that way, they are either three different materials or at least one of the materials is present in one mode in one state, for example, solid, and another mode in another state, for example, liquid. And obvious things you think of in addition to sulfuric acid are, for example, crystals of solid sulfur and droplets of molten sulfur. The temperature where sulfur would melt is reached somewhere down in the lower cloud region of Venus. So we have three different modes here. And the nephelometer, the LCPS is also capable of telling for the larger particles what shape they are.
The way the LCPS works is kind of neat too. For the smaller particles, it simply sends in a laser beam, here we are using a laser, and measures how much light is scattered off them and figures out from that how many there are and roughly how big they are. For the larger particles though, the laser is allowed to shine through them and there is an array of light detectors on the other side and it literally counts the shadows of the individual cloud particles. And if they're big enough to cover more than one of the little dots that detect the light, you can actually figure out the shape. Well, the point of figuring out the shape is, if it's round, if it's spherical, it's liquid. If it's not round, it's got to be solid, because a liquid will pull itself into a spherical shape when it's floating in the air by its own surface tension. However, if you're dealing with a dust particle, say, a solid particle from the ground, or if you're dealing with some sulfur that has formed a crystal, then you will have a non-spherical shape, and at least for the larger particles, you'll be able to tell that.
It is found from
studies of this sort of thing on Earth. And believe me, this sort of diagram has been compiled many times in studies of, for example, smogs on the Earth, or natural smogs on the Earth. It is found that when you have a broad distribution like that, not all clustered very tightly around the average size, but lots and lots of sizes and the average not all well defined, it's usually solid particles. By both criteria, mode 3 is solid. Mode 2 and 1, and there's mode 1, exclusively mode 1 of the upper cloud region, are liquid. So what we have, to summarize, is some very tiny and some intermediate-sized liquid droplets in the middle cloud layer, and a population of some kind of solid crystal. Those solid crystals are not dust from the ground. Proof? If the dust were coming up from the ground, we'd encounter it on the way down, and we don't. Below this cutoff, at 19 miles above the surface, the atmosphere of Venus is immaculately clean of cloud particles, or of anything else, of particles. And that condition, according to our data, continues all the way down to the surface. The Russians also had a nephelometer. They didn't have an LCPS, a cloud particle size spectrometer, but they had a nephelometer on each of their landers. And in fact, they had the Mir 9 and 10 as well. And the Russians claim that there are two additional cloud layers, one at about 15 miles and one just a few miles above the surface. We did not see those. At this point, we don't know whether the difference is there are different cloud layers at different places on Venus and they happen to land in a different place, which would be believable, or that there is something wrong with the Russian data, or heaven forfend, there is something wrong with our data. But at least we know that the nephelometer on the large probe was still working when it hit the ground, because it continued to work after it hit the ground, and it sent back reports that it was seeing a cloud of dust kicked up by the landing for about 2 minutes after the landing. So the nephelometers didn't, it's not just a matter of they didn't send back data because they weren't working. They didn't send back data because there were no data to be sent back. That, by the way, tells you that at least in one place on the surface of Venus, it is soft dirt. I don't think I mentioned last time that the Knight probe survived for a very, very brief period of time, about 1 second, at the end of which it was destroyed by the temperature and pressure. We can tell from the way, they can cut out that 1 second of telemetry into, you know, thousands, literally, of individual pieces, and study the exact way that the signal died off. And the way it died off was not the way it would die off. It was just a matter of the probe landed, it continued to transmit, but it happened to roll. Remember, it's conical on the bottom. It happened to roll in such a way that it wasn't aimed at the Earth. That is not what happened. It was cut off in such a way that it was killed by the temperature. So apparently, the Knight probe hit something hard and cracked. The Day probe hit something soft, and that may have been the reason the Day probe was able to survive. Yeah. Right. At that pressure, right. Right. And see, the thing is, just because the temperature is the right region, is the right amount for sulfur to melt doesn't necessarily mean it'll do it. You can have metastable solid sulfur at somewhat above that temperature. You can have metastable liquid sulfur at somewhat below that temperature if you formed it at a hotter place and then moved it, say, upward in the cloud layers to a colder place. So it's not as though I can draw a line on this graph and say below this line solid sulfur will be liquid and above this line it'll be solid. It's not that simple. But yes, you do of course take the pressure into account, and that does change the melting and boiling points very severely.
How can instruments tell the difference between a lot of small particles and a few particles
that are
still small but
they're
big?
That's why you have both the nephelometer and the cloud particle size spectrometer. The nephelometer cannot tell the difference between a lot of small particles and a small number of big ones. All it knows is I am seeing a certain amount of infrared reflected back to me at a certain height. On the other hand, the nephelometer can take data more frequently and thereby give you a more complex curve, if you wish, more detail visible in the curve than the LCPS can. The LCPS curve is complex enough, and those wiggles are real. I think you can see it's an enormously complex structure. The mere fact is there are the three layers. We don't really, we have no understanding of, people are just beginning to try to work out models for it, and all those wiggles back and forth too. And you have pretty much the same structure as the four landing sites. They're not identical, but pretty much the same. On the other hand, the particle size spectrometer, as its name implies, measures the individual size particles. And so it tells you the kind of data that you want, but it can only send back a transmission every 8 seconds. The nephelometer sends back data every 1 second. This is the LCPS, and the LCPS was only on the large probe. There was no CPS on the small probe. There was a nephelometer on all four probes. People, I'm sure, will put a composite together of the nephelometer data from all four probes. It has not been done yet, to my knowledge. There's going to be a major presentation of Pioneer Venus data at the meeting of the Division of Planetary Sciences of the American Astronomical Society in St. Louis at the end of October, and then there will be an even more major one as a special issue of the Journal of Geophysical Research about an inch thick, which is coming out sometime between the middle and end of next year. And I would imagine that, you know, one or the other would have that kind of thing, but so far there just hasn't been time. You say, well, why not? I mean, how much trouble does it take to take four sets of wiggles and put them together on one piece of paper? But see, it's not that simple. You've got to do all kinds of calibration for exactly how high above the surface each probe was at each moment. You can plot the data from a single probe and say, well, this is roughly the altitude scale, but, you know, really what this scale is time, okay? And they tried their best to calibrate it for altitude, but somebody came along and said, look, all those numbers are 2 miles off. I wouldn't be at all surprised. But you see, if you're trying to intercompare data from a separate probe, they can't be 2 miles off, or else you'll see what look like differences, and they're not differences at all, just that one of your altitude scales is wrong. And that kind of calibration takes forever. It's done. The radio tracking does it and so forth, but it takes a long, long time to haul those data out of the raw numbers. So that's why you don't have a whole lot of intercomparison yet.
Okay, so as I started to say, this set of histograms tells you the number of particles irrespective of their size. One particle, one pope. Okay? Whether it's 1 micrometer in size or 30 micrometers in size. But of course, the 30 micrometer ones are much heavier than the 1 micrometer ones, right? And so there's a second set of bars here which tells you how much weight there is in each one of these size ranges. And the people in the back sure can't see those bars, but the bottom line on it is that although in the middle cloud layer, the most numerous particles are the little ones, the mode one. By far, most of the mass of the cloud is the relatively non-numerous but individually heavy mode 3, and that the mass distribution peaks at about 8 micrometers. Okay, now we go down to the lower cloud region, and we find that mode 1 is much stronger. There are as many of them as there were in the upper cloud layer. Mode 2 is essentially gone. And mode 3 is even stronger, and particles occur up to even bigger sizes. In fact, there are enough of them that occur even off the previous diagram that
Robert Goldenberg, who is the principal investigator on the LCPS, is quite confident that there are particles big enough that they fall. If they're little, they don't fall. For those 1 micrometer particles, the terminal velocity, you know terminal velocity? As you fall through an atmosphere, air friction gets more and more as your speed becomes greater and greater, and eventually the air friction that is trying to slow you down becomes equal to the gravity that's trying to pull you down, pull you in the other direction, and thereafter you simply fall at a constant speed, and that's called terminal velocity. A sports parachutist jumping out of a plane a few miles above the Earth will reach terminal velocity within just a few minutes, and I don't know, anybody into that kind of thing? I think it's about 100 miles an hour. 120 miles an hour? Okay, fine. But for these little cloud droplets in that dense atmosphere, the terminal velocity is several millimeters per hour. And so the tiniest little updraft is enough to keep them up there forever and ever. But as you get to bigger and bigger particles, you get to greater and greater terminal velocities needed. And Nolenberg thinks that if you have particles that are around 100 micrometers in size, and he thinks they probably are such particles, it rains. So what I'm telling you is that on Venus, it either rains molten sulfur or sulfuric acid. In either case, however, the rain boils long before it reaches the surface and becomes a gas in the atmosphere. And indeed, it is that process which generates these major differences in the composition of the atmosphere below the clouds versus above the clouds that I told you about last time. Stuff rains out from the bottom of the clouds. There you see the rain. It's that lower thin haze region, and somewhere around there, in fact, that is just about the point where sulfuric acid was vaporized, somewhere around there it turns into a gas, but the gas is this process is happening below the clouds, but it's not happening up above the clouds. So you get all that sulfur dioxide down below the clouds and not above them. Well, the lower cloud region is only a mile in vertical height, but it's the one that contains the greatest amount of material. The blue curve gives you the number of particles without respect to their size at every layer in the cloud, and the scale for it is there is one particle, there's 10, there's 100, there's 1,000, and for very low densities there is 1/10 of a particle per cubic centimeter, which is to say 1 particle every 10 cubic centimeters. I hope you're not bothered by something like 1/10 of a particle. It's just a matter of expressing a statistic. Like, the average American family has 2.4 children, Tom, Dick, and Harry.
This curve, the green one, the green one tells you how much mass there is
per cubic centimeter. In other words, this one takes into account the fact that all particles are not created equal, that some of them are heavier than others. And so I think you can see that because of all those mode 3, which you notice dominate the mass spectrum in the lower cloud region in the same way as they do in the middle cloud region, all those mode 3 means that there is much, much more material in the lower cloud region in terms of matter per cubic, actually matter per cubic meter. There's still very thin clouds. We are talking about down here, that is 1 milligram, 1,000th of a gram per cubic meter. A cubic meter is a volume a little bit bigger than a yard on a side. And we are saying there is 1,000th of a gram of cloud matter in a region of clouds like, for example, there. And the best you can do is 1/10th of a gram, 100 milligrams, at the very, very densest part of the lower cloud region in an entire cubic meter. So these are very, very thin clouds. There is not much material involved. You mustn't think that the clouds form one of the major constituents of the Venus atmosphere. It's mostly gaseous carbon dioxide, and that is true regardless of what the clouds are made of, just because they are such a small fraction of total mass. Now, since this diagram was prepared, we have learned that the structure is even more complex than you see here. The bottom third of the lower cloud region does not have mode 3, it does not have mode 2, it has only mode 1, just like the top cloud region. The lower haze region is very, very thin haze, thousands of a milligram, or a millionth of a gram, a microgram, per cubic meter, is exclusively mode 1 again, as though the material raining down from that bottom part of the lower cloud region. At the large probe site only, there was another very brief spike in the data, about 1,000 feet below the bottom of the lower cloud region, which has been given the name pre-cloud layer, that was not observed in the nephelometer data at any of the other sites. The suspicion is that some wind tore off a little bit of the bottom of the lower cloud layer, and there was a clear gap. Also, yeah?
Is it possible that instead of not being really consistent with the state, it's really consistent with the time? You're going through the hurricane going on, and the
Pioneer Venus instruments were not chosen as just a bunch of instruments, each of which somebody thought would be a good idea. They were chosen so that the data from one experiment fed into others in just the kind of way you're talking about. There were elaborate measurements made of what winds were affecting the four probes on the way down, both the vertical winds and the horizontal winds. And so I can tell you absolutely confidently, no, there was not a hurricane going on, and therefore these are relatively stagnant features. You can argue that the pre-cloud layer is due to the action of wind, and you can argue the lower thin haze region is due to material very slowly falling, but there was nothing that would cause changes as major as you're seeing here as a result of wind, the way you're talking about. So it's a very good question, and the Pioneer Venus people anticipated needing to be able to answer such questions. It's a very carefully integrated package of experiments. For the first time in the history of the U.S. Planetary Exploration Program, they have, as a scientist on Pioneer Venus, not just a bunch of individual people, each with his own experiment. They have those, but in addition, there's a whole panel of people called interdisciplinary scientists who have no responsibility for any single experiment, and whose entire function is just to go around and bug the guys who have the individual experiments and try to tie it all together. All the questions seem to be from the front. That's not because I'm ignoring the back. Anybody else? Okay, well, again, please, if you have any points, ask. The greatest of all is that there's a little bit of mode 2 up in the upper cloud layer, contrary to what you're seeing here. And that, I think, updates you on this enormously complex structure. The reason I've gone through it in so much detail is, number one, I think it's kind of fascinating we can do this, but number two, just to give you some idea of what a job it is going to be to explain this incredibly complex structure of variations as you go down through the clouds. Oh, yes, and perhaps the most remarkable feature of all, which you don't see in the LCPS data because they only take data every 8 seconds, and these regions I'm talking about are so thin that they're blurred in with their neighbors. Above and below, the main cloud depth, the lower cloud region, the one that has most of the mass of the clouds of Venus, even though it's only a mile thick, above and below is a region about 300 feet thick, in each case, of absolutely clear air. And so, somehow, the main cloud deck is being kept physically separated from the one above it and the one below it. Real narrow region, but it's there in all four sets of nephelometer data.
Jim, yeah. What was the time between the hit about 50 miles and then around 20 miles? How long did it take?
How long did it take the probe to go through this grass? Oh, 15, 20 minutes, as a guess. It's of that order. I guess the best way to tell you that would be that every one of these dots, every one of these data is a second apart. I'm sorry, that's not true. These are not the raw data. These are average data. Yeah. Yeah, because those are 8 seconds apart. Yeah, okay. And so it's a little bit complicated because this is on a large probe, remember, and you jettison the parachute in the middle of these data. So it starts falling at a faster rate as soon as you jettison the parachute. They wanted to jettison the parachute about 2 miles below where they actually did, and they finally had to settle on the altitude that they did because laboratory tests showed that at the temperatures and pressures on Venus, although not at Earth temperatures and pressures, the material the parachute is made of would begin to get eaten by the sulfuric acid. And they wanted to jettison the whole thing rather than have bits and pieces of it go and maybe cause the probe to start moving, you know, for a while in a direction that they didn't want. The material the parachute was made of was Dacron, nothing fancy. But for that reason, nothing terribly resistant to sulfuric acid at 900, not 900 degrees Fahrenheit yet, but a couple hundreds of bottom there. Okay, so much for this very complex cloud structure. Let's get back to pictures, which are always a little bit easier to comprehend. Here you see a nice one that was taken, in March or April of this year. You can see the two very bright polar rings, and you also see the Y feature, which I told you about last time. Remember last time, the Y was simply supposed to be a place where the divergence of circulation around the eye of Venus, the subsolar point, became made visible at the winter, but the air freezes solid at the surface and falls on the ground. In fact, a third of the atmosphere of Mars is tied up in that winter polar cap, made of frozen carbon dioxide, dry ice, which extends from the pole of Mars down to about the same latitude on Mars as we are here on the Earth. And then every summer it goes away again, or it almost goes away again, almost away. Here is a diagram which shows temperatures as measured on the very first orbit by the OIR, the Orbiter Infrared Radiometer, which has been plotted in such a way that the brighter the color, the hotter it was. There is our friend the polar ring. Oh, the way it's been plotted, this is as though you were looking on a map in which the north pole of Venus is there at the center, and the equator is this ring around the edge. So you're seeing the northern hemisphere of Venus. The reason for this shape is the orbit is not circular. It's very eccentric. And so the orbiter was coming in towards the surface, getting toward closer and closer toward the surface as it went along. The field of view of the radiometer is a particular angle, and so as you were far out, you saw all this width, and then as you move farther and farther and farther in, you see a narrower and narrower width. This diagram was referred to affectionately by all concerned in Pioneer Venus as the pork chop. The terminator between day and night is this line right there, vertical line. Day is on the left, night is on the right. Okay? The polar ring extends all the way around. The reason that it doesn't seem to in this diagram is this is a very raw, early stage of processing the data. But it's good enough to show one of the most remarkable things the Pioneer Venus discovered. Draw that imaginary line between day and night. Look there and look there. Where is it higher? Taking a look. At a given latitude, where is it hotter? Sorry. Hotter in the night? Well, it's almost the same, but it's actually a little bit hotter in the night. Look, and this bright is here, and compare with this bright is here. A little bit brighter. We do not understand the reason for this. We can explain why the pole is hotter than the equator at these heights. So far, nobody's been clever enough to come up with a model to explain why the night side would be hotter than the day side. Yeah. Okay, in the first place, the air at these heights is being heated by lower air, not by the ground. And so what you want is some sort of thermal lag. The air is able to hold the heat for 12 hours, except that it's not 12 hours. This planet rotates once every 243 days, and there is no way the air is holding the heat that long. But it's further complicated, it's further complicated by the fact that the upper portion of the air rotates once every 4 days. see. And it's not clear whether we're in the region of 4-day circulation in the level that is shown in the pork chop.
Was that the sunrise terminator or sunset terminator?
Was that the sunrise or sunset terminator? Venus rotates in the clockwise direction as seen from above the pole, and so we are having sunrise here and we are having sunset here. Yeah, it's supposed to be coldest before sunrise. Yeah, as a matter of fact, thank you for saying that, because when we got data over in this portion, which of course we have by now, even though I don't have a diagram for it, it turns out that it's hottest at sunrise. It's not as hot as sunset now. Well, yeah.
I don't understand why the pole is hot. What is the mechanism as to why the air was circulating towards the pole, because the air was colder?
Okay, right. I asked the same question. The air is colder at the pole farther down. All right. As a result, you got to remember how rapidly the density of the air falls off as you go up. Most of the air on Venus is within a few miles of the ground. And in fact, it's even more complicated than that, because at the very bottom, the air is the same temperature all the way around. And as you saw from those data from the four probes, there's not much difference in the temperature from one place to another, even higher up in the altitude, but there is a little bit. And there is a layer, the layer where you first get a difference is such that it's coldest at the pole. That has the...